content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article by Michelle Darasaw is titled, The Critical Lessons Michelle Obama is Passing Down from Her Mom to Malia and Sasha. There's an old Indian proverb and quote by Ravathi Sankaran that says, Mother is the best and the first teacher to the child. For former First Lady Michelle Obama, her 81-year-old mom, Marian Robinson, was nothing but a positive influence in her life. In a personal essay for People, Mrs. Obama wrote about the valuable life lessons her mother instilled in her and how she's passing them down to her two daughters, Malia Obama and Sasha Obama. The Becoming author highlighted how her mom allowed both she and her brother Craig Robinson to express themselves and ask questions, no matter how pointless they seemed. As I've grown older, I've seen how her manner and conversation also reflects her approach to parenting, Mrs. Obama wrote. Because when it came to raising her kids, my mom knew that her voice was less important than allowing me to use my own. That meant she listened a lot more than she lectured. Growing up, she was willing to endure endless questioning from me. Mrs. Obama recounted those inquiries from her childhood growing up in Chicago's South Side in the People essay, pondering over everything from eggs for breakfast to the size of homes in various neighborhoods. She and my father, Frazier, were wholly invested in their children, pouring a deep and durable foundation of goodness and honesty, of right and wrong, into my brother and me, Mrs. Obama added. After that, they simply let us be ourselves. Allowing kids the space and freedom to be themselves, listening to young adults rather than lecturing, and empowering children to express their views are three things Robinson taught Mrs. Obama by example. And now, not only is Mrs. Obama handing down those positive messages to her own daughters, but she's working to uplift other young girls all over the world through her post-White House initiative, the Global Girls Alliance, and the educational programming she and former President Barack Obama have coming to Netflix. I see now how important that kind of freedom is for all children, particularly for girls with flames of their own, flames the world might try to dim, Mrs. Obama wrote. It's up to us, as mothers and mother figures, to give the girls in our lives the kind of support that keeps their flame lit and lifts up their voices, not necessarily with our own words, but by letting them find the words themselves. Our next article is titled, Oh, Readers Share When They Became Aware of Their White Privilege. Over the past year, the rest of the country became painfully aware of what Black Americans have long known, that systematic racism affects everyone, those who reap its benefits as well as those who suffer its atrocities. Through their voices must guide our progress. It's not Black citizens' responsibility to fix our national race problem. White people need to look inward, then act outward. To that end, we asked white O readers when they were most acutely aware of their white privilege, and what, in the wake of thunderous calls for justice, they are doing to dismantle the status quo. Here's what they had to say. Elizabeth Passarella, 43, of New York City. I grew up in the South and moved to New York City after college. In my first few years in the city, I would have defended myself as someone who was definitely not racist, as I had never engaged in any directly discriminatory action or used racist language. I was friends with Black people in school. I loved the Black women who cared for my grandmother. I was exceptionally nice to the Black men and women who served me when I ate lunch at a friend's country club. When I was in my late 20s, I began to understand the depth of racism in my own heart, how ingrained it was, and how I categorized and justified oppression, thinking I had somehow earned the advantages I had in life. I believed that all people were made in God's image and equally worthy, but my thoughts and actions didn't always show that. I became acutely aware of my white privilege when I began searching for a public school for my oldest child, seeing the inequalities in New York City's education system, based on property values and sliver-sized zones and the entitlement of wealthy and middle-class white parents who revolted when districts were redrawn to include less advantaged neighborhoods. That was eye-opening, mostly because I assumed New Yorkers were progressive. Yet when it came to switching their children to a school that was majority Black or Latino, they balked. I've had to fight that urge in my own heart. But what I've realized is that even in a school that isn't perfect, none of them are, even if my kids went to the worst performing school in the neighborhood, they would still be fine, largely because they are white. They already have an advantage that they didn't earn. Ellen Hewer, 64, Los Angeles. My father was extremely racist and forbade us to watch shows like Julia, starring Diane Carroll. He'd come into the room where I would be watching, scream profanities, and violently unplug the TV. Today I'm what's called a Foley artist. I use props to create sound effects for a movie after the scenes are filmed. If someone gets stabbed, I take some celery and break it for bones crunching, and maybe squish a grapefruit for the added effect of gore and blood dripping. I rarely get to view the performance ahead of time and have to make a very quick assessment of emotional content without knowing the storyline. When I worked on 12 Years a Slave, I already had a deep awareness of racism and violence imprinted in my body due to my father's archaic prejudices and insidious beatings. Even though I was safe inside my studio, 12 Years a Slave was uniquely uncomfortable due to its long scenes of violence. The lynching, feet dragging in the mud, the sound of the creaking rope from early dawn to sunset, the whippings, so many lashings. The unbearable cries of a young Black girl being raped over and over. As I worked on those scenes, on some subliminal level, I became the slave owner. I was the killer of dreams, the man of power. Having to recreate sounds to marry to this painful imagery week after week caused me to wrap my sessions early and retreat into a dark world of isolation and shame. The truth is, these underlying tensions that came out of years of slavery, oppression, and violence still exist. I thought they were healed. I was wrong. Beth Court Voltmer, 58, New Virginia, Iowa. In a small discussion group for a course I was taking on racism, I described a time when a cop and I bantered back and forth after I'd been pulled over. A young Black man said, "I could not ever do something like that." We discussed how parents of white children tell them that they may lose their driving privileges if they get pulled over. For a Black family, it's a totally different conversation, one of life or death. Sheila Morreale, 51, Franklin, Tennessee. In college, as a social work student, I attended classes that attempted to help us understand our clients' life experiences and our own individual biases. Back then, I naively believed I was different. I only became acutely aware of my white privilege when Trayvon Martin was murdered. I looked at my own sons, who were only slightly younger than Trayvon, and it hit me that I never once had to have conversations with them about what they could wear, where they could go, and how they should react to a police officer if they were approached. It literally wasn't necessary for me. I remember seeing Trayvon's parents grieving and angry. I wept and prayed for them. And yet I knew if that were my boy, George Zimmerman would be in jail. Not autographing bags of Skittles and living in some disgusting version of fame. It made me feel embarrassed, guilty, and ashamed of what I had not grasped all those years ago. Now I've joined Beloved Community, a movement in the Episcopal Church that promotes awareness and discussions around racial injustice and inequality. I am participating in a group book study about white fragility. I'm having very open and difficult conversations with my three children. And most important, when I see someone in my community say something belittling or negative about race or gender, be it on social media or in everyday conversation, I call that out. I'm Southern. I've been raised to smile and not cause a fuss or offend. But guess what? I'm over that mindset. If individuals can risk their lives, why can't I be a little uncomfortable voicing my opinion? I desperately want to be better for my community, my family, and my country, and I'm trying. Catherine Isabel, 45, New Orleans. The murder of George Floyd and the ensuing protests drove home how differently I view the police as a white person, that is, primarily as a source of help and protection versus fear and danger. As a result, I've decided to try to actively address racism in my workplace by joining the Accountability and Inclusion Committee at my predominantly white company, which I hope will lead to the hiring of more people of color, especially Black people. And in my child's school, by writing the administration to ask what steps they're taking to address racial bias in their educational and disciplinary methods. Sherry Pritz, 44, Dallas. I'm realizing that I can't just view myself as not racist and therefore not part of the problem. That's not good enough. If I'm being honest, I know I still have a lot to learn and that there are many aspects of white privilege and supremacy that I'm not even conscious of yet. I've been making an effort to learn more about systematic racism and what it means to be anti-racist. As someone who is pregnant, I'm thinking harder about how to raise my child. Before, I thought that all I needed to do was teach him that everyone is equal and buy toys and books that celebrate diversity. Now I'm becoming aware that I need to take it further, but I'm not sure what that looks like yet. Marie Sassy, 67, New York City. People sometimes say it is class, not race, that is an issue. But if you are black, it doesn't matter if you are richer, smarter, more polished. That hasn't prevented a future president from being mistaken for a waiter, or a man who'd become U.S. Attorney General from being stopped by police when running to get to a movie, and these are just the tip of a very large iceberg. Jennifer Jones, 43, Indianapolis. In 1996, I was a sophomore at Purdue University. As a member of student government, I was invited to an event at the Black Cultural Center. I was the only white person in a room of more than 100 black students. Initially, I felt uneasy, and then it hit me. The discomfort I was experiencing was likely how many black students felt daily on campus. I finally recognized my own privilege of being a part of the dominant culture. Today, we can no longer deny the inequality the black community is experiencing, particularly at the hands of law enforcement. My parents' generation has always given the benefit of the doubt to law enforcement. Their mentality was that people don't get into predicaments with police unless they do something wrong. While I believe most police are good people who want to help others, society will no longer give them the benefit of the doubt because of the actions of a few bad cops. We must actively identify racist behavior and remove those officers when found. Katie Nelson, 40, Philadelphia. I've always known about racial injustice, but until recently I didn't have the language to talk about how I relate to it. White was neutral instead of being a race. My liberal parents taught me that minorities could catch up because of the civil rights movement and that our country was on a path of progress. Now I understand that racial categories are much deeper than that. In a lot of ways, we haven't progressed at all. I now see that I have a race too, even if I feel uncomfortable about it. Andrea Sisk, 37, Pittsburgh. I teach middle school. I was telling my students a story about listening to music while taking a walk one night. They told me I shouldn't do that, especially not with both earbuds in. It's not safe. I live 2 miles from them, but I can walk in my neighborhood at any hour of the night and be safe. They can't walk home from the bus stop in broad daylight and be safe. Lately, I've tried to remind myself that every person of color I meet has experienced more trauma than I ever will. Laura Pickett, 35, Indianapolis. In white privilege America, when we were in our first car accident as teens and called our parents, we heard something along the lines of, "I don't care about the car, that's a material object, are you okay?" Yet many of those same white Americans are looking at the damage done by a small percentage of protesters and valuing that over the message they are trying to carry. I see race differently after George Floyd's death. I understand I need to be more active in fighting for racial justice. I was too passive before. Alexander Landfair, 35, Brooklyn. I see conservative friends of mine take issue with generalizations being leveled against all police, and they speak about what they see as the erosion of individual responsibility. It's difficult for them to recognize that this is truly a systematic problem. But it's important to remember that over the past 50-some years, police have been increasingly addressing issues that rightly belong to social workers, mental health workers, and healthcare workers. Police are failing terribly because we're asking them to do the impossible. This is the logic behind the movement to defund the police, which is really about cutting back their responsibilities and investing that money in entities better equipped to meet community needs. I realize it might seem that I'm talking now about the police, and your question was really about race, but the whole issue is that the black experience is so intimately and absurdly connected with policing. Woody Wheeler, 69, Seattle. What am I doing differently now? Well, I took part in one of the Seattle protests, and my wife and I are increasing our donations to civil rights groups like the Southern Poverty Law Center, and pursuing the idea of creating a new science and environmental college scholarship fund for people of color to honor Christian Cooper, the Audubon Society board member and birder from New York City who recorded a racist confrontation he was subjected to by a white woman in Central Park. We're also redoubling our efforts to get out the vote in the next election by writing letters through the Vote Forward campaign to defeat the current white supremacist regime that plagues our country and incites conflict along racial lines. We financially support a number of Senate candidates who believe that Black lives do matter and support Joe Biden for president, hopefully with a Black female VP. Our next article by Gabby Dunn is titled, "It's taken me a long time to open up about my mental health, but even longer to connect it to my finances." The first couple of times I was given the diagnosis bipolar 2, I ignored it. I didn't tell my parents or my friends. I never followed up. I just pretended I hadn't heard it. Bipolar is a mood disorder with two main mood swings: depression, down, and mania, up. Depression alone is a bit more common and, in my experience, easier for the average person to understand. But depression does not just mean sad. When I'm depressed, I'm in physical pain, sore on my chest and upper back in a way that makes me walk hunched over in the middle or cry out if touched the wrong way. I cry from being sad, but also from actual pain. Mania, or hypomania, is harder to grasp. Mania can be euphoric. Nothing can stop you. You're the best. It can make me super social and highly flirtatious. It scatters my thoughts so I stop and start a million projects. I once wrote 60 pages of a feature film in 3 days without sleeping. I feel more inclined to drink or do drugs. It can also be depressive. I can get mean or desperate. Either way, I stop thinking. I lose control. Bipolar disorder is episodic. A person with bipolar can seem very stable for a long time and then suddenly go off the rails. Without medication, this is what happens to me. For someone who makes a living being transparent about her dating, sex, and family life on the internet, I've left out a big chunk of my story. So I'll come clean here. I'm bipolar. And for as long as it has taken me to open up about my disorder, it has taken me even longer to connect the dots between my mental health and my finances. This includes spending money I didn't have on whims I didn't need. I told myself all of these impulsive purchases were deserved. There were specific purchases I needed to do my best work. For instance, the book on writing musicals. I never wrote a musical, unless you count my unproduced treatment for the rock opera What's My Age Again? The Blink 182 musical. The only way I could write my new brilliant novel or my award-winning article idea was if I bought myself a new computer. I'd stay up all night talking myself into randomly filling out graduate school applications for schools in Japan and buying books on Japanese culture. When I was manic, I wanted to spend all my money because life was a breeze and who cared about social constructs like money? When I was down, I desperately needed material things to make me feel better. No matter what state I was in, I convinced myself not to look at my finances or try to sort out my bank accounts or plan for the future because it was too stressful and I was too fragile right now. My first breakdown took place in 2008 when I was a sophomore in college. I had become too anxious to eat, and so I was stick thin and shaking constantly. I don't fully remember how that episode ended, but all I know is in photos of myself from back then, I'm pale and sickly. And I never did anything to fix it. I waited it out and kept working myself to death at my job and at school, the newspaper, the honors program, classes. I didn't go on meds then because the idea never occurred to me. The anxiety eventually became more manageable, and I convinced myself it was a fluke. Just like my money troubles, my mental health was a pattern I was staving off instead of treating. 4 years later, in May 2012, I crashed again. This was the second time I'd gone from intense manic work ethic to crushing suicidal depression in the course of 1 year, but I still didn't understand that my brain chemistry might be to blame. I'd been riding high. When my birthday came around in June, I threw myself a massive party at the Improv Theater where I performed in downtown New York City. The boy I was interested in didn't show up because he was fighting with his girlfriend, so I got super, super drunk. The next day, I woke up with a massive hangover and I couldn't stop shaking. Alcohol can exacerbate mental illness because it's a depressant. My hangover eventually subsided, but later that night, I was still feeling crappy. I also would not stop convulsing, shuddering every so often between waves of nausea. I had bad hangovers before, but this was more than that. I was totally unable to eat. The mere thought of food caused the shaking to intensify. I tried to eat some cooked spinach, which I normally love, and I threw it up violently. Something was really wrong. My sister-in-law drove to Brooklyn from Nyack and picked me up at the apartment of a girl I was casually seeing. She took me back to her and my brother's condo. I spent the next week in the same smelly gray pajamas, unable to get off their couch. I could barely move unless it was to blink. I stared off into nothing, basically comatose. I couldn't express what was wrong, and so I didn't talk. I did not sleep. Eventually, I became okay enough, or annoying enough, to be allowed to go back to my apartment in Harlem. I was embarrassed to have been such a burden on my family. I must have gone back to working, but I don't remember it. I figured this extreme manic depressive episode was a one-off, or a two-off, thinking back to 2008. But 2 days later, I bought, wait for it, a plane ticket to Europe. Yes, you read that right. I spent the remaining money I had in my bank account, which was maybe $800, on a nonstop flight to Paris. I planned to go for 2 whole weeks. In Europe, I slowly went more insane. I had done no research. I was not aware of the exchange rate, so I used that as an excuse to not understand how much I was spending. I had too much anxiety to talk to anyone. At night, to assuage my anxiety, I drank a lot. One day I took a train to Versailles and realized I had no money to eat while I was there, but it didn't matter because the combination of hangover and anxiety made me throw up on the lawn of the palace. I wrote in my journal for that day, "Do you think Marie Antoinette ever vomited here?" My last day in Paris, I went to a lesbian bar with a girl I was sort of dating's ex who was also visiting the city. Leaving the bar, I reached into my purse and realized my wallet had been stolen. I had my passport in my bag so I could feasibly get home, but I'd lost my credit and debit cards, $80 in cash, and a pair of earrings I'd bought in New Orleans that had sentimental value. I went back to my day job and took on more hours. Eventually, I left to take a higher-paying full-time job with much-needed benefits. I still had credit card debt from my mania, but I never thought about it. I figured it was a problem that future me could deal with. I was convinced I was special and was going to succeed so wildly at this young age that the debt didn't matter. It was the era of Donald Glover and Lady Gaga, after all. I was meant to make millions by the time I was 25. To be 25 sitting on 25 mil, as Drake puts it. On the rare occasions that I logged into Bank of America online, I would peek at the number in my checking account and then close it quickly, like it was an ancient cursed book. I overdrafted constantly. Every time I ran out of money, my mom would, behind my dad's back, put $50 into my account to cover the $30 overdraft fee and give me $20 to play with. Love, but also enabling. The boat kept filling with water, and I kept trying to drain it with a thimble. I talked about this with no one. I figured everyone I knew was doing the same thing, racking up credit card debt and praying for a light at the end of the tunnel. My mental health spiraled downward. My shakiness and anxiety hadn't fully subsided since the summer, and I decided it couldn't hurt to look into medical help beyond talk therapy. In winter 2012, I started seeing a pay-as-you-can psychiatrist who prescribed me Klonopin and Celexa to specifically address the anxiety and depression. On this medication cocktail, I was exhausted. I slept for days. I missed work. My roommate called my parents. I'd been acting like a zombie and was speaking incoherently. One night I woke up in a haze with my dad standing over me. He'd flown from South Florida to bring me home. I went off the meds I'd been on. I saw and spoke to almost no one. I cried all the time. I slowly got better. A year later, I moved to LA. My job provided health insurance, and since I was stressed about the move, I went back on meds, Zoloft and Klonopin. I thought I was so responsible. I thought everything was stable. But I had another breakdown in 2016. A psychiatrist in LA asked if I'd ever been diagnosed with bipolar 2, and I finally said yes, I had been, multiple times. If I was going to really fix my financial troubles, then I had to admit there were other things at play beyond irresponsibility and youthful ignorance. I could learn about taxes and individual retirement accounts, and I could work really hard to get out of debt, but in the end, I was always one mental lapse away from destroying my credit score. I was on medication for depression, but that wasn't addressing this problem. 8 years after my first breakdown, I finally started on Lamictal, specifically for bipolar disorder, and gradually I got a handle on my brain. I'm not saying medication is the answer for everyone. I'm not a doctor, and I'm not you. Also, my meds are now covered by insurance. My therapist costs me $125 a session, and my psychiatrist costs me $225 every 2 months. But it's money I have now that I'm willing to spend on myself. I know not everyone is in that position. But another thing that saved me from financial ruin was realizing that there were other psychological factors that contributed to my overspending. The impulsivity of mania is aided and abetted by shopping apps. People don't even see the cash in their paycheck before it's swiped into Ubers and Amazon Prime. I've deleted food delivery apps and other triggers from my phone for that reason. When you're feeling crappy, comfort spending lifts your spirits, and when you're flying high, you can experience what's called manic spending. An example of manic spending is when I feel I've worked hard at something and therefore deserve new sneakers immediately. Comfort spending is when I'm sad from working too hard and need new sneakers to feel better. Even if you don't have bipolar disorder, you might be buying material things to fill the emptiness inside. Manic spending is no different than the hypersexuality or anything that comes with mania, Julia Fast, a writer, educator, and expert on bipolar disorder, said on my podcast, Bad with Money. No frontal lobe, no ability to say, I can't afford that. All of that is gone. Money and mental health are tied up in a chicken and egg situation. People with severe mental illness can be more susceptible to job loss, debt, homelessness, and money mismanagement. And those problems can also lead to poor mental health and keep them from getting treatment. I still have these blue periods with days of painful sobbing. I still overspend on manic impulse buys and have to constantly stop myself from getting a puppy on a whim. But I'm aware of it, and I'm being treated for it with medication and lots of therapy. The comedian Sarah Schaefer, who speaks openly about her mental health and her stand-up, told me in a 2016 episode of my podcast that she had $65,000 of credit card debt because she used money as a way to regulate her depression. I would get depressed and I would shop alone. I still like shopping alone. I don't like people being there because I don't like judgment, she said. When you're depressed and you feel like you can't control anything, making a purchase is something you can control. Starting in childhood, whenever something bad happened, Schaefer said her parents would buy her a pound puppy toy. She made a dangerous connection between spending money and improving her mood. We started joking that any gift for when you felt bad about anything was just called a pound puppy, she said. A pound puppy is a familiar mollifier, if not a familiar name for it. I'm sure many people in line at a Sephora or Foot Locker right now would tell you the same thing. Buying yourself a little present quiets the sad, even if you don't have a diagnosed mental illness. Spending gets you high, but we can't live our lives surrounded by pound puppies. We have to eventually address the barking. Our next article by Elena Nicolou is titled, Dirty John's Betty Broderick is up for parole again in 2032. The second season of Dirty John tells the story of Betty and Dan Broderick, a couple whose divorce and its bloody aftermath made headlines in 1980s San Diego. Though Betty Broderick is alive today, she won't be able to watch the brand new series she inspired, or the Emmy Award-winning made-for-TV film based on her life either. For years, Betty and Daniel enjoyed the lifestyle that his lucrative career as a medical malpractice attorney afforded, and became well-known in San Diego society circles. In the 80s, it all fell apart during what Oprah Winfrey called one of America's messiest divorces. In 1991, Betty, then 44, was found guilty on 2 counts of second-degree murder for killing her ex-husband Dan and his wife Linda Colquina Broderick. Now 72, Betty is serving out her sentence, which was 32 years to life in a California prison. She was denied parole for the third time in 2017. To this day, she believes in her heart and in her mind that they deserve to die, the parole official said in 2017, speaking of Betty's victims. Dirty John, the Betty Broderick story, focuses on the lead-up to that fateful evening. Speaking to OprahMag.com, star Amanda Peet, who plays Betty in the show, says Dirty John gives a deeper picture of how this suburban housewife became a raging murderer. She adds, there were many different facets that led up to Betty's snapping. Your allegiances are complicated through the story. Here's what you need to know about Betty Broderick and where she is now. Remind me, what did Betty Broderick do? Since 1989, Betty has been defined by the actions she took on a single evening. In the early morning hours of November 5th, Betty went to the mansion that her ex-husband Dan shared with his new wife, 28-year-old Linda Colquina Broderick, and shot them both dead with a 5-shot revolver. I shot Daniel T. Broderick III because I wanted to survive, to live, far more than I wanted him to die. In the heat of battle, I let rip, Betty wrote in her memoir, Betty Broderick, Telling on Myself, which was published in 2015 while she was incarcerated. Betty claimed that she only planned to confront Dan and Linda and then take her own life. It made sense to me, taking the gun to make them listen to me, Betty told Oprah in 1992. The murder followed a particularly messy divorce. The couple endured drawn-out divorce proceedings, during which they fought for custody of their 4 children and argued over their finances. Things got heated. Betty drove her car into Dan's new mansion and lit his clothes on fire, per the LA Times. However, Betty may have been driven to those actions by psychological torment. During the trial, she claimed Dan was abusive and reiterated that in her memoir. For example, Dan was seeing Linda for years and denied the affair the entire time, she claimed. Betty also wrote that Dan used his prominence in the San Diego community to cheat her out of a fair settlement and said that she struggled to find legal support willing to go against him in court, according to the LA Times. Amanda Peet gives her take on what happened between Betty and Dan. He was gaslighting her, Peet tells us. Her identity was wrapped up in being Mrs. Dan Broderick. And so, when that got taken away from her, I think she became untethered. And to what extent she was mentally ill before that, I don't think there's an exact right answer. But clearly, Dan's behavior exacerbated this vulnerability that she had. The jury was torn over Betty's guilt. On the surface, the case seems cut and dry. After the shooting, Betty turned herself into the police, and yet Betty insisted she was innocent and pled not guilty on 2 counts of murder. During Betty's first trial in 1990, the jury was deadlocked over the extent of her guilt. Just how much were her actions premeditated, and how much were they the result of a frayed mind? Essentially, was Dan Broderick a stand-up lawyer who was harassed for years by his needy ex-wife? Or was he a manipulator who slowly took away everything Betty valued, from their children to their home, so that she had no way of escape? His was the white-collar way of beating you, Betty said during the trial, per the New York Times. If he had hit me with a baseball bat, I could have shown people what he did and made him stop. Betty was found guilty of second-degree murder during her second trial in 1991. The jury ultimately decided that Betty did not plan the murders beforehand. If she had, she would have been convicted of first-degree murder. At one point, Betty said she was having a pretty good time in prison. Betty is serving out her sentence at the California Institute for Women, or CIW, in Chino, California. She happens to be in the same prison as Patricia Krenwinkle and Leslie Van Houten of the Manson family. During an extensive interview with the San Diego Reader back in 1998, Betty painted a picture of her then life behind bars. She was at the time involved in 12 volunteer groups, including GED tutoring and recording books for Braille readers. For years, she worked as a prison janitor. Hey, I'm the queen of housework. That's what I did in life, she said during the interview. Betty also added that she was getting 4 hours of sleep. I have too much energy for prison life. At night, when the rest of the inmates were asleep, Betty said that she watched nature films on her TV set with headphones. Usually I manage to have a pretty good time, and that pisses them off. In her 2015 memoir, Telling on Myself, Betty gave an update about her prison life. I'm still a mom and a teacher in here, just as I was out there, she wrote, mentioning that she continued to help with legal work and GED tutoring. She said she doesn't drink, smoke, or do drugs and is well treated by the staff and inmates alike. I'm basically happy here. I'm safe and there's a kind of freedom in that. She's a grandma now. Betty's four children, Kimberly, Lee, Dan, and Rhett, were in contact with her at the time the San Diego Reader interview was published in 1998. Betty's children visited her in prison for her birthday and Mother's Day, but not Christmas and school holidays. I didn't want for all their memories of those times to be of visiting mom in prison, Betty said in 1998. A decade later, Betty appeared to still be in contact with her brood of chicks, as she calls them in her memoir. In 2009, Betty sent an LA Magazine reporter a family portrait taken in prison of herself, her four children, and her two granddaughters. In 2010, her children testified at her parole hearing per the San Diego Union-Tribune and were split about whether she should be released. Her daughter Lee told the parole board that she had a room prepared for her mother. She should be able to live her later life outside prison walls, Lee said. Dan disagreed, saying she still hung up on justifying what she did. As of 2015, when her memoir came out, Betty wrote that she talks to and sees her children and grandchildren. She published a memoir in 2015. Want to hear Betty's story and Betty's words? Betty Broderick, Telling on Myself, was published in 2015, 25 years into Betty's prison sentence. In a letter she sent to an LA Mag reporter in 2009, Betty previewed the book. The book explains who I am as a person, how I was raised, and the values I hold, and how why you get pulled in and trapped in abusive relationships that you can't get out of. The book will be damn good if I can just finish it. Longhand is like a chisel stone process, very tedious and slow, she wrote. Dirty John is hardly the first work about Betty Broderick. Since her high-profile case, Betty has been featured in numerous news programs, TV shows, movies, books, and more. Famously, millions tuned in to watch Oprah interview Betty in prison in 1992, and that's just the start. Her case later inspired two TV movies, the Emmy-nominated A Woman Scorned, 1992, and Her Final Fury, 1992. Three books were written about her in the 90s, Until the 12th of Never by Bella Stembo, Forsaking All Others, The Real Betty Broderick Story by Loretta Schwartz Noble, and Hell Hath No Fury by Brenna Taubman. The 1999 documentary A Woman Scorned tried to give a fact-based analysis of the crime, as did other news specials like one on 2020. Allegedly, she inspired a 1991 Law & Order episode and an SNL skit starring Gabriel Byrne and Mary Catherine Gallagher, one of Molly Shannon's most famous characters. She was denied parole twice. Betty was denied parole in 2010 and 2017 and will be up for parole again in January 2032. She's definitely someone with no regrets, no remorse, unrepentant, and completely feeling like they are in the right, San Diego County Deputy District Attorney Richard Sachs, who was present at the parole hearing in 2017, told NBC. Betty addressed an earlier parole denial and her own unrepentant attitude in her 2015 memoir. I don't think the parole board understood me at all because it wanted me to say there was no reason for what I did. But there was a reason. There were 1,000 reasons. Just no excuses, she wrote in her memoir. Though she expressed regret, she justified why she killed Dan and Linda. I said that I should not have killed them. Of course I should not have killed them. What I did was inexcusable. All killing is wrong, and war and peace, and anger and in cold blood. But when you are trying to save yourself, maybe it is explicable. If you don't control them, they will control you, she added. She apologized for her actions, sort of. I'm sorry I'm in prison, but I'm also sorry that I ended two lives. The thing is, though, I feel like I've never been free unless I say that I ended the lives of two people who never did me any harm, and I can't say that, she wrote in the memoir. She claims she's a political prisoner. In 2017, when Betty was 69, she was featured in the Reels docuseries Murder Made Me Famous. According to People, Betty was unable to conduct an in-person interview as she had done with Oprah from prison in 1992. Instead, she wrote a 4-page letter to Murder Made Me Famous producer Katie Dunn, reflecting on the parole board's decision. I have met all criteria for parole, and my release date was 2010. Now I am only a political prisoner. They have no reason to deny my parole, Betty said. As she writes in her memoir, being denied parole is a revival of every ugly losing moment in what seems to still be Dan Broderick's justice system. Our next article by Melanie Hamlet is titled, Men Have No Friends and Women Bear the Burden. Kylie Ann Kelly can't remember the exact moment she became her boyfriend's one and only, his What Would I Do Without You? But she does remember neglecting her own needs to the point of hospitalization. I talked him through his aspirations, validated his opinions, and supported his career. I had to be his emotional guru because he was too afraid to admit he had any emotions at all, recalls the 24-year-old English teacher who was studying for her PhD at the time. Kelly's boyfriend refused to talk to other men or a therapist about his feelings, so he'd often get into funks, picking pointless fights when something was bothering him. Eventually, Kelly became his default therapist, soothing his anxieties as he fretted over work or family problems. After 3 years together, when exhaustion and anxiety landed her in the hospital and her boyfriend claimed he was too busy to visit, they broke up. Kelly's story, though extreme, is a common example of modern American relationships. Women continue to bear the burden of men's emotional lives, and why wouldn't they? For generations, men have been taught to reject traits like gentleness and sensitivity, leaving them without the tools to deal with internalized anger and frustration. Meanwhile, the female savior trope continues to be romanticized on the silver screen, thanks Disney, making it seem totally normal, even ideal, to find the man within the beast. Unlike women, who are encouraged to foster deep platonic intimacy from a young age, American men, with their puffed-up chests, fist bumps, and awkward side hugs, grow up believing that they should not only behave like stoic robots in front of other men, but that women are the only people they are allowed to turn to for emotional support, if anyone at all. And as modern relationships continue to put pressure on the one to be the only one, where men cast their wives and girlfriends to play best friend, lover, career advisor, stylist, social secretary, emotional cheerleader, mom, to him, their future kids, or both, and eventually on-call therapist minus the $200 an hour fee, this form of emotional gold digging is not only detrimental to men, it's exhausting an entire generation of women. The idea of an emotional gold digger was first touched on in 2016 by writer Aaron Rodgers with a tweet that continues to be reposted on social media, both by women who married self-described feminist men and by those with more conservative husbands. It has gained more traction recently as women, feeling increasingly burdened by unpaid emotional labor, have wised up to the toll of toxic masculinity, which keeps men isolated and incapable of leaning on each other. Across the spectrum, women seem to be complaining about the same thing. While they read countless self-help books, listen to podcasts, seek out career advisors, turn to female friends for advice and support, or spend a small fortune on therapists to deal with old wounds and current problems, the men in their lives simply rely on them. It's for this reason that artist Lindsay Johnson jokingly calls herself everyone's beck and call girl. Not only does she take care of her husband and children, she just moved in with her mom to take care of her as well, because she knows her brothers won't. Both recently divorced, her brothers are already turning to her, but never to each other, to provide the support their wives used to. Men drain the emotional life out of women, says the 41-year-old who lives in Nashville, Tennessee. I love them, but good Lord, they become the bane of my existence. Johnson admits she enables her brothers by saying yes all the time, partly out of guilt, but also partly because she loves being needed, to feel important, Johnson explains. It's a catch-22. Eventually, it becomes too much, and I end up exhausted and resentful. Like Johnson, most of the women I spoke to for this piece believe that their ego and self-worth are often wrapped up in being a man's crutch. But the older women get, the less willing they seem to be a man's everything. Not only because we become more confident, wise, and, well, tired with age, but because our responsibilities pile up with each passing year. All the retired women I know are busier than ever, taking care of spouses, ailing friends, grandchildren, and parents, then doing some volunteering on the side. Meanwhile, things only get worse for women's aging partners. Men don't usually put the effort into maintaining friendships once they're married, Johnson says. The guys at work are the only people other than me that my husband even talks to, so when some of these men retire, they expect their wives to be their source of entertainment and even get jealous that they have a life. Johnson jokes that women her mom's age seem to be waiting for their husbands to die so they can finally start their life. I'll get a call saying so-and-so kicked the bucket, and sure enough, his widow is on a cruise around the world a week later with her girlfriends. But unlike women in our mother's generation, Gen Xers and millennials are starting to hold their partners accountable, or they're simply leaving. Ruby Merez, a comedian in her early 30s living in Los Angeles, got so fed up with functioning as an unpaid therapist that she gave her then-boyfriend of 5 years an ultimatum. Get a shrink or we're done. He had no excuse not to go since his job paid for it. But here I was, a struggling freelancer with no benefits, always finding a way to prioritize therapy and yoga. He refused for 2 years, then finally agreed after multiple arguments, though it took prodding and reminding from her. He rarely went, says Merez, often blaming the therapist for scheduling conflicts, and only conceded to couples counseling after she did all the work to find the therapist and set up the appointments. A little wiser, Merez broke up with her most recent romantic prospect after he said he didn't need therapy because he had her for that. Men are taught that feelings are a female thing, muses Johnson, whose husband often complains about her wanting to talk deep. Though Johnson brags about how wonderful her husband is, grateful he doesn't exhaust her with his neediness like a lot of her married friends, she does wish men were encouraged to examine and explore their emotions in a safe setting, like therapy, before they boil over. I'm tired of having to replace another broken bedside table because he didn't realize he needed to talk about his feelings, she admits. Johnson's not alone. The persistent idea that seeking therapy is a form of weakness has produced a generation of men suffering from symptoms like anger, irritability, and aggressiveness. Because not only are they less likely than women to pursue mental health help, but once they do, they have a hard time expressing their emotions. This is so common there's even a technical term for it, normative male alexithymia. For millennial men in particular, a major challenge is understanding they need help in the first place. Men have never been taught how to identify what their emotional needs are, their thoughts and feelings, or to express how someone can help them fulfill these, explains Dr. Angela Beard, a clinical psychologist at the Veterans Affairs in Dallas, Texas. Forced to question long-held masculine ideals, therapy can be a meaningful and transformative process, even for her most reluctant patients. No one has ever asked them what masculinity means to them, and they've never asked themselves, says Beard. They can get a lot of insight from this process. But individual therapy, which can cost upwards of $200 per session and is rarely covered by insurance, isn't financially viable for everyone. Group therapy is an accessible alternative, ranging from $50 to $75 per session, but the practice faces added stigma because of its association with inpatient psychiatric hospitals and rehab facilities, as well as court-ordered treatments for anger, domestic violence, sex offenses, and substance abuse. A lot of people, men and women both, have this stereotype of group therapy from movies like Adam Sandler's Anger Management, where everyone is sitting in a circle crying and one person is telling their life story and it's really awkward. But group therapy can be nothing like that, explains Beard, who leads various group therapy sessions. When newer men join the group, she explains, the tenured members often normalize therapy for them, explaining that it's a safe place to discuss deeply personal feelings. These military men, some with combat trauma, experience great relief in having their needs validated by peers. members become comfortable enough to share their honest impression of another member, opening the door to interpersonal feedback that they may never hear elsewhere. Still, the statistics are bleak. Only 5% of men seek outpatient mental health services, despite feeling lonelier than ever before. In a recent British study, 2.5 million men admitted to having no close friends. What's more, men conceal pain and illness at much higher rates than women and are 3 times more likely than women to die from suicide. Black men face an added set of barriers, including systemic discrimination, racial stereotypes, and cultural stigma against mental illness. So what then is a man to do when he needs honest, unbiased support from someone other than his partner, but is unwilling or unable to try therapy? Some American men have found a powerful solution: men's support groups. After several failed relationships, Scott Shepherd realized that despite being an empathetic, self-aware guy, he was still missing a key element to his emotional health: a few good, woke-ish men. Previously, Shepherd leaned heavily on women for emotional intimacy because, shocker, that's who he felt safest with. The problem was he became dependent on the women he opened up to and kept repeating the cycle. "I saw it really was me that's the problem. It didn't matter who the girl was, the same issues just kept coming up," admits the Portland, Oregon-based outdoor adventure leader. "These old patterns are pretty deep. I needed support and intimacy that wasn't tied up into one relationship." So Shepherd turned to the internet, downloaded a men's group manual, and invited a few guy friends who he knew would be receptive. He capped the membership at 8 and set up a structure with very clear boundaries, the most important being what's talked about in men's groups stays in men's group. At first, Shepherd thought his men's group would be a place to unload on someone other than a woman, but it's become more than that, something he believes all men truly want and need but can't admit it. "In our culture, men have always found ways to be near each other, but it's never been centered around feelings," he explains. "Men are taught the remedy to heartbreak is to get drunk with your buddies, objectify women, and go out and get laid, to basically distance yourself from your feelings and channel them into an aggressive outlet. We use sports as an excuse to bump up against each other, so desperate we are for human touch and intimacy. But this kind of closeness is based in camaraderie and aggression, not vulnerability and trust. The former is very surface level and not nearly as satisfying as the latter." My friend Steven, who asked me to omit his last name to protect the privacy of his family, actually credits joining a men's group with helping him find the necessary tools to ensure a healthy marriage. "It's changed my life and secured the stability of my family," he admits. Steven's men's group, which focuses on everything from setting and achieving goals to redefining masculinity itself, is a larger, more organized version of Shepherd's, with self-governed chapters all over the world. But like Shepherd's, it prides itself on privacy. The group doesn't have a website and ushers in new members by word of mouth. "I can take down my facade and get real about what I'm scared of or what I'm sad, self-conscious, or mad about, all without judgment or fear that it will get out of our confidential circle," says Steven of his group. "We deliver the truth and difficult feedback even if it might not be well received." Not only has the group taught him alternative ways to be a man, husband, and father, it has given Steven a space to think about what kind of man he wants to be. "Until I did this work, I didn't know there was anything but the singular default definition of manhood," he explains, adding that he's now a better listener, is more generous with his affections, and has realized the importance of being present. Steven checks in with his group weekly, sometimes even daily over text, depending on how much support he needs to stay on track with his goals. "We're actually strongest when we lean on each other and do it together," Steven says. "Knowing that other men have problems, no matter how it looks on the outside, makes him feel less alone," he says, "and less ashamed." Shame, Brené Brown found in her years of research, is the single biggest cause of toxic masculinity. Whereas women experience shame when they fail to meet unrealistic, conflicting expectations, men become consumed with shame for showing signs of weakness. Since vulnerability is, unfortunately, still perceived as a weakness instead of a strength, having hard conversations that involve vulnerability is something men often try to avoid. It's for this reason that to yield positive results for men's support groups, men must enter such groups with that very intention, not just to find buddies. Whether they're members of small groups like Shepherds or more mainstream groups like Stevens, the men I spoke to all agreed on one thing, that these groups made them better partners to the women in their lives. And it's not just men saying this. I witnessed my friend Liz's marriage strengthen after her husband Randy co-founded a men's group with his best friend 3 years ago that offers a confidential, neutral space for men in their isolated New England town to share their fears without judgment. This isn't him going to grab a beer with guys. He's going to find psychological and emotional support from men who understand his problems, Liz explains. They're not just getting together to have a bitch fest, gossip, or complain about their lives. They're super intentional about what they're talking about, why, and what's important to them. Randy's group, which caps membership to 6 people at any given time to build trust with each member, also adheres to strict confidentiality rules. Whenever it's time for the men's group to meet at one of our houses, the wives clear out, toting their kids and babies behind so the guys can have a private space to do this important work, says Liz. A group text chain enables the men to check in with other members between meetings, and for some of these men, this is their first truly authentic relationship with a peer. Similarly, now that Shepherd, the outdoor adventure leader, no longer needs a partner to feel emotionally connected and understood, he says he can go into his next relationship without being emotionally needy or selfish. It's really not healthy to have all your chips in one container with anyone. After watching TED Talks like Tony Porter's A Call to Men and Justin Baldoni's Why I'm Done Trying to Be Man Enough, Shepherd has realized how important it is for men to start redefining what it means to be a good man to the women in their lives. He believes men are having a reckoning right now, not just with their past wrongs, both individually and collectively, as we've seen with the Me Too and Time's Up movements, but with who they are and want to be. Our culture pits men against women and makes it impossible for men to feel anything but shame if they act too feminine in front of other men, he says. But some men are recognizing that internally, they aren't nearly as strong as they think they are. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.